Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Greetings, lovers of Mother Earth. Today I'd like to jump right in with a big question. Can you be a serious environmentalist without cutting down drastically on animal foods? That is, cutting way down on meat, eggs, and dairy. I'll cut right to the chase and say that a sustainable future on this planet requires a drastic reduction in livestock and dairy production. If you consider yourself an environmentalist and you haven't already cut way down on meat, eggs, and dairy, are you willing to do your share? This question is just the kind of question I like to address here at Just for the Health of It. This question gets at the heart of the intersection of social justice and personal human health, not to mention humane treatment of billions of animals. Whatever personal difficulty you may face in cutting way down on meat, eggs, and dairy, you should take some comfort in that eating a plant-based diet can offer you profound improvements in your health. So let's dig into the environmental impact of animal-based foods. First category, food security. Globally, one-third of crops are fed to animals. That's about two-thirds in the U.S. Feeding crops to animals to produce food results in a 75% loss in caloric value and over an 80% loss of protein. In the category of water pollution, livestock produce 7 to 9 times more manure output than humans do. And as it happens, fecal matter makes it into the water supply. In fact, most food poisonings, even if from plant sources, are traceable back to livestock. Often these concentrated animal feeding operations, factories. Livestock production accounts for 60% of nitrogen pollution released into the environment. And nitrogen, along with phosphorus, are what we see that bring about the huge algae blooms that we have here in the Toledo area. In the category of land competition, some livestock rearing can be considered resource efficient by using land unsuitable for crops or forests, or by consuming crop residues, but only about 30% of current production levels could be reared in this way. And livestock are linked to about 70% of historic deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon. Regarding climate change, studies show that to stop global temperatures rising beyond the dangerous 2 degrees Celsius level of climate change, demand for livestock products must be reduced. 1/7 of global greenhouse gas emissions are due to livestock production. And regarding biodiversity loss, livestock production is a major driver of biodiversity loss globally, accounting for about 30% of human-caused losses. What does the future look like? If the entire world were to eat the average North American diet, this would result in a 320% increase in the global consumption of animal protein and require a doubling in the area of global cropland. So why does all this matter? Livestock are the single largest human-caused source of non-CO2 greenhouse gases, producing 44% of methane and 53% of nitrous oxide emissions. Non-CO2 gas reductions are essential to achieving global climate targets. And depending on the accounting method used, livestock produces somewhere between 50 and 80% of global agricultural emissions. If current trends towards increasing consumption of livestock continue, and if a cap on emissions is put in place to limit warming to 2 degrees Celsius or less by 2050, 70% of the cap would be taken up by the livestock sector alone. Studies show that in order to achieve greenhouse gas reductions from the livestock sector, consistent with keeping climate change below the dangerous 2 degrees Celsius level, reduction in demand of animal foods will be essential. So, how big of an opportunity does this present? Modeling suggests that worldwide adoption of the Harvard Healthy Diet, which does include a modest amount of meat, could reduce the cost of cutting emissions in the energy sector by up to 50%, and that under a global plant-based scenario, savings could be as great as 80%. A recent review of mitigation opportunities in agriculture up to 2030 compared the Harvard Healthy Diet scenario to actions in other sectors and found it to have a higher potential than any other option. Another personal bonus for eating a plant-based diet is that toxins like pesticides and heavy metals get concentrated as you go up the food chain. So eating lower on the food chain greatly reduces your dietary exposures to toxins. For myself, living simply is something that I value, and living simply dovetails well with stewardship of the earth and opting out of the rampant consumerism endemic in Western culture. I also see living simply as a way to increase our personal freedom as well as our collective freedom. And as yet another bonus in today's show, on this theme of living simply, I am going to debut another feature of Just for the Health of It, that is poetry. Since poetry is one of my passions and another of my unpaid gigs, I will share poetry with you on occasion. Today's poem is entitled A Taste for Happiness. Dining with kings and queens, courtly balls, knightly duels, and priestly indulgences, you can avoid it all if only you are happy eating beans. Thank you. You can clap or snap your fingers if you like. Better yet, eat more beans for your own benefit, the benefit of our planet, and as one way to carve out a little more personal economic freedom and a healthier body politic. As a matter of credit, I'd like to note that this poem is inspired by a traditional Sufi story of Nasruddin, who was eating a poor man's diet of chickpeas and bread. His neighbor, who claimed to be a wise man, was living in a grand house and dining on sumptuous meals provided by the emperor himself. His neighbor told Nasruddin, "If only you would learn to flatter the emperor and be subservient like I do, you would not have to live on chickpeas and bread." Nasruddin replied, "And if only you would learn to live on chickpeas and bread like I do, you would not have to flatter and live subservient to the emperor." In my humble opinion, anything that loosens our subservience to the empire or emperor is healthy for each of us and all of us. Here at Just for the Health of It, the People's School of Public Health, the people's health is not academic. You're listening to WAKT, We Act, 106.1 FM Toledo, your local and slightly loco non-commercial radio station. Now let's move to our next segment, the Public Health News Research Roundup.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this Public Health News and Research Roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this Public Health News and Research Roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
What do we got first? In blow to climate, coal plants emitted more than ever in 2018. Sorry, folks, going to start with some bad news from the Washington Post. We are headed for disaster, and nobody seems to be able to slow things down, a Stanford University professor said. Global energy experts released grim findings, saying that not only are planet-warming carbon dioxide emissions still increasing, but the world's growing thirst for energy has led to higher emissions from coal-fired power plants than ever before. Energy demand around the world grew by 2.3% over the past year, marking the most rapid increase in a decade. Fossil fuels satisfied nearly 70% of the skyrocketing electricity demand. This report underscores an unnerving truth about the world's collective efforts to combat climate change. Even as renewable energy rapidly expands, many countries, including the United States and China, are nevertheless still turning to fossil fuels to satisfy ever-growing energy demand. Climate policies around the globe, despite some limited pockets of progress, remain woefully inadequate. They're not even robust enough to offset the increased emissions from economic expansion. When it comes to coal use, to limit temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius, we would have to decline by as much as 78% in just over 10 years. Again, coal emissions are still rising. The new results dashed earlier hopes that global emissions might be flattening and starting to decline. As a result, optimism from earlier this decade has largely faded. International efforts to combat climate change have struggled to maintain momentum, and the U.S. government has undergone a reversal of priorities. We are in deep trouble. The climate consequences are catastrophic. I don't use any word like that very often, but we are headed for disaster, and nobody seems to be able to slow things down. Next up, from EE News, another black eye for America's energy capital. The fire-fueled plume that darkened a swath of the Texas sky last week was just the beginning of an unfolding disaster in this U.S. oil and petrochemical hub. They've dealt with spiking levels of benzene, which can cause cancer, fires that reignited, and the breach of a dike that led to the partial closure of the Houston Ship Channel. The incident strikes at the heart of Greater Houston's ability to offer a safe environment for the roughly 7 million people who live in and around this longtime energy capital. And from AP News, flooding poses potential risk for 1 million private wells. More than 1 million private wells that supply drinking water in mostly rural parts of the Midwest could face the risk of contamination from floodwater, posing a health concern that could linger long after the flooding subsides. The high water and swift current carries raw sewage from overburdened treatment plants, animal waste, and pesticides from farm fields and spilled fuel. Whatever was on the land is now in the water. Contaminated water can carry bacteria such as E. coli that can cause gastrointestinal illness, reproductive problems, and neurological disorders, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Infants, young children, pregnant women, elderly people, and people with compromised immune systems are particularly vulnerable. About 15 million U.S. households, most often in rural areas that don't have access to public drinking water systems, rely on private wells. These wells are not typically regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency, so it is up to the well owner to make sure the water is clean. Owners of private wells use a variety of methods to remove contaminants, including filtration systems, water softeners, distillation systems that boil out the impurities, and disinfectants, such as chlorine. But if floodwater gets into a well, these efforts may not be enough. Okay, in case you haven't noticed, today's focus is on environmental health, particularly related to climate change and climate instability. Climate change is harming the health of Americans and people across the world. This is due to climate pressures such as increasing temperatures, more extreme weather, which means more hot and more cold, rising sea levels, and extremes of precipitation. And this occurs through various pathways: extreme heat and temperatures, air pollution, water contamination, changes in vector ecology, such as that of mosquitoes and ticks, increasing allergens, changes in the food supply and quality, and population displacement. In fact, in the coming decades, there's expected to be tens of millions of climate refugees. And these various exposure pathways lead to a variety of health outcomes. heat stress and heat stroke, respiratory disease, cardiovascular disease, gastrointestinal illness, vector-borne diseases like Lyme, West Nile, and Zika, mental health illness and worsening mental health, adverse birth outcomes, and even physical trauma and death. So, climate change is a public health issue. Back to the news stories from the New Yorker. Louisiana's disappearing coast. Now, when listening to this article, think man's hubris, our arrogance in trying wholesale control over large swaths of nature. Since the days of Huey Long, Louisiana has shrunk by more than 2,000 square miles. If Delaware or Rhode Island had lost that much territory, the U.S. would only have 49 states. Every hour and a half, Louisiana sheds another football field's worth of land. Every few minutes, it drops a tennis court's worth. On maps, the state may still resemble a boot. Really, though, the bottom of the boot is in tatters, missing not just a sole, but also its heel and a good part of its instep. A variety of factors are driving the land loss crisis, as it has come to be called, but the essential one is a marvel of engineering, thousands of miles of levees, flood walls, and revetments have been erected to manage the Mississippi. As the Army Corps of Engineers once boasted, we harnessed it, straightened it, regularized it, shackled it. This vast system built to keep southern Louisiana dry is the very reason the region is disintegrating, coming apart like an old shoe. But if control is the problem, it must also, by the logic of the Anthropocene, to be the solution. And so a huge new public works project is getting underway, this one aimed not at flood control so much as at controlled flooding. But New Orleans' world-class drainage system, like its world-class levee system, is a sort of Trojan solution, since marshy soils compact by dewatering, pumping water out of the ground exacerbates the very problem that needs to be solved. The more water that's pumped, the faster the city sinks. And the more it sinks, the more pumping is required. You get the picture. Atmospheric warming, ocean acidification, sea level rise, deglaciation, desertification, these are just some of the byproducts of our species' so-called success. I'd just like to add that if this is success, I shudder at the prospect of failure. And from Hakai Magazine, Wounded Wilderness, the Exxon Valdez oil spill 30 years later. On the surface, Prince William Sound appears to have recovered, but you don't have to dig too deep into the soil or into memories to find the spill's lingering effects. Lingering oil persists at hard-hit sites, although only a fraction of the original 42 million liters, it remains nearly as toxic as the day it poured from the tanker. Research indicates it is not degrading. And in a related story from the Washington Post, chemical that EPA allows to help clean up oil spills sickens people and fish, lawsuit claims. People exposed to the chemical suffer coughing, wheezing, and rashes. Near Venice, Louisiana, oil continues to seep from a Taylor Energy operation destroyed during a hurricane nearly 15 years ago. The Environmental Protection Agency has allowed 25 years to go by without updating the National Contingency Plan to respond to oil spills. In the absence of an update, the EPA has continued to allow emergency responders to use a chemical mixture called Corexit to disperse oil into droplets that allows microbes to further break it down. About 20% of nearly 5,000 Coast Guard personnel who responded to the BP spill and were exposed to the toxin reported persistent coughing. Others experienced wheezing and trouble breathing, according to a 2018 study commissioned by the National Institutes of Health. Dispersants in oil combined to form droplets of chemical, enhanced oil, is more deadly than oil alone to people. Some scientists say that the use of Corexit should be eliminated and replace with a system that uses microbes to break down and naturally consume large volumes of oil. Researchers for a study in 2013 found that when Corexit and oil are mixed, toxicity increased 52-fold for a microscopic zooplankton at the bottom of the marine food web, a major source of nutrition for ocean animals. The moral of this story seems to be that we have environmental problems and more environmental problems from the so-called solutions. Going to a different type of energy problem, first of its kind U.S. nuclear waste dump marks 20 years. In a remote stretch of New Mexico desert, the U.S. government put in motion an experiment aimed at proving to the world that radioactive waste could be safely disposed of deep underground, rendering it less of a threat to the environment. 20 years and more than 12,380 shipments later, tons of Cold War era waste from decades of bomb making and nuclear research across the U.S. have been stashed in the salt caverns that make up this underground facility. Each week, several shipments of special boxes and barrels packed with lab coats, rubber gloves, tools, and debris contaminated with plutonium and other radioactive elements are trucked to the site. It's 80% through its lifetime and has disposed of less than 40% of the waste and has cost more than twice as much as it's supposed to. Whether the repository is ultimately deemed a success may depend on the human factor. After all, missteps by management were blamed for the 2014 radiation release. The federal government still has no long-term plan for dealing with such waste. Nevada's proposed Yucca Mountain project is mothballed, and no other permanent disposal proposals are on the table. In other waste news, plenty of waste today, from Free Malaysia Today, after China banned e-waste rains on Malaysian soil, thousands of containers from abroad have made their way into ports in the country. They carry computers, televisions, VCRs, stereos, copiers, fax machines, and other electronic gadgets. But they are unusable, long discarded by consumers in developed countries. They are known as electronic waste or e-waste. Until recently, the majority of e-waste from the U.S. was shipped to Asia, notably China. That stopped in 2018 when Beijing announced a drastic national sword policy to ban hazardous materials. Thousands of containers laden with e-waste from Europe and the U.S. were illegally imported into the country through ports. In most cases, importers, who are in fact syndicates which smuggle e-waste, disguise their cargo as scrap metal or other names listed as permissible goods by customs. These are then transported to numerous illegal e-waste treatment plants. Many recycling plants have turned into highly polluting dump sites for e-waste. Even more alarming is the fact that these plants are located close to residential areas, and the emissions from the waste could cause serious health problems for the people living there. One major harm from e-waste is lead, which is used for the soldering of circuit boards found in almost every electronic appliance. It is dangerous for both children and adults, and could cause anything from attention-related behavior problems to tremors, high blood pressure, miscarriage, and psychiatric conditions to heart disease. The cadmium found in chip resistors and semiconductors could cause irreversible effects on human health. It accumulates in the kidney and liver and also causes neural damage. The mercury found in relays, switches, and printed circuit boards, meanwhile, could cause brain damage, respiratory, and skin conditions. The hexavalent chromium found in the corrosion protection of untreated galvanized steel plates, decorators, or hardeners for steel housing could cause asthmatic bronchitis and DNA damage. E-waste, which is the scheduled waste, waste which is intractable and difficult to dispose of without special technology, could also have an adverse impact on the environment, contaminating natural resources as well as water and marine life. China had valid reasons to rethink its role as a global waste treatment hub. China's Shantou region was a massive e-waste recycling center about 30 years ago, perhaps the largest e-waste site in the world. Today, its land, air, rivers, and groundwater are contaminated. And to another type of waste, plastic waste. from Watershed Sentinel, will Canada back a proposal to stop scuttling plastic waste to poorer nations? As one scientific paper puts it, plastic waste is now so ubiquitous in the environment that it has been suggested as a geological indicator of the proposed Anthropocene era. In response, some countries have gotten serious about plastic waste. The EU voted for a complete ban on many single-use plastics last October. The UK is legislating minimum recycled content on plastic packaging and plans to make producers pay the full cost of recycling their wares. In India, disposable plastic bags are unlawful. In Kenya, getting caught with a disposable plastic bag can earn jail time. In contrast, Canada's approach to the plastic crisis has been long on rhetoric, short on legislation, and heavily invested in plastics production. The evidence overwhelmingly shows that recycling cannot be a solution for the plastic waste issue. It can be used in limited situations. Right now, a dismal 9% of plastic waste is recycled globally. Roughly 40% of plastic is produced for packaging and single-use items. Nor can plastic be recycled repeatedly, unlike steel or glass. After one or two passes through the circular economy, plastic is degraded and contaminated and headed for the landfill or incinerator. The problem is set to get much worse. Plastic production is expected to triple by 2050. Hydraulic fracturing has made natural gas a cheap and common feedstock for plastic production, spurring huge investments in plastics infrastructure. So too will emissions grow. The production of plastic is estimated to consume 20% of annual oil consumption globally by 2050. Until the beginning of 2018, China accepted 45% of global plastic waste. For the first world, it was a tidy solution for much of the 380 million tons of plastic waste produced annually. Research published in 2017 estimates that 90% of all marine plastic waste enters the ocean from only 10 rivers, and 8 of them are in Asia. The narrative is that these countries are the biggest responsible for polluting our oceans, and that it is often because we send them our plastic. They don't have the infrastructure to deal with that plastic, and then it ends up in the ocean. Not only are we causing the problem, we're also blaming developing countries. The market for poorly regulated or illegal plastic waste processing is now quickly shifting to other countries, such as Thailand, Malaysia, Vietnam, and Indonesia. The world agrees there's a plastic waste crisis. Can it agree on a solution? From National Geographic. The tyranny of the minority, their statement declared, as environmentalists denounce the Americans for what they said was slowing progress on marine plastics by diluting a resolution calling for phasing out single-use plastic by 2025 and blocking an effort to craft a legally binding treaty on plastics debris. The Americans sought to define marine debris as an issue solved exclusively by waste management, while virtually everybody else in the room has focused on the idea that there is a problem with production and the use of single-use plastic. Few were surprised when the United States balked at targets, deadlines, and any reference to bans or levies on various plastic products or reductions in plastic production and consumption. By the UN's own estimates, 2 in 5 people, or 40% of the global population, lack access to waste disposal systems. So far, no global entity has come up with any plan to address waste disposal on that scale. Even creation of the most comprehensive waste disposal systems may not be enough to keep up with the accelerating pace of plastics manufacturing. The plastics industry has grown so rapidly that half the plastic on Earth has been made since 2005, and production is expected to double in the next 2 decades. So far, 127 countries have adopted regulations regarding plastic bags, according to UN tallies as of July 2018. 27 countries have adopted bans on other single-use products, including plates, cups, cutlery, or straws. India, home to 1.3 billion people and the world's second most populated nation, continues preparations to abolish all single-use plastic by 2022 in a plan announced last year that may be the world's most ambitious undertaking. The European Parliament is preparing to put into force a sweeping single-use plastics directive, it passed last year that bans the single-use plastics most commonly found on European beaches. Well, that does it for our roundup. I would remind you just back earlier in the show when we talked about reducing eating animal-based foods as a way to deal with the environment. If you're depressed by the environmental reporting here today, know that that's one thing you can do that can both improve your own personal health and those that you love, as well as improve the health of the planet. If you have any questions or comments, like to get some feedback about the show, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. Again, that's wakt@toppun.com. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.